Welcome to another edition of Sanity Mind. Your host, Derek Davis. And today we plunge deep into the cultures of consciousness, and particularly psychedelic consciousness. Today, when we're recording the show, not when you're listening to it, April 18th, the day before Immortal Bicycle Day, when Dr. Hoffman first intentionally ingested LSD in 1943, a day commemorated around the world and also commemorated, though not explicitly, by the significant psychedelic conference that's happening this weekend, again, after the weekend you'll be hearing this conversation, in the Bay Area. MAPS, of course, incredibly dynamic and forceful operation in the world of psychedelic science, and there's been quite a renaissance, almost an explosion of interest in the scientific and medical sides of psychedelics, their healing capacities, and a kind of new raft of scientific studies have been going down, and MAPS supports that stuff and has increasingly come to organize these enormous conferences with lots of science types and other psychedelic aficionados. And while I'm very excited and encouraged by the upswing of this return to psychedelic science, to above board mainstream labs, studying these materials, coming up with models, trying to understand how they could be useful in healing and in other functions. I'm not always that excited about the way that MAPS has sort of shifted the dialogue in contemporary psychedelic culture. Back in the 2000s, I went to a number of Mind States conferences, and these were really wonderful gatherings of visionary artists and curious characters and underground chemists and above-ground scientists and journalists and all sorts of characters. And these people still show up in droves to MAPS conferences, don't get me wrong. But there's been a shift as psychedelics have stepped closer to the mainstream, and the idea that at some point perhaps these things could be available for certain psychological or even physical healing or made available to people at the end of their lives to deal with the suffering and pain, psychological and physical, of the end of life, is that as we move towards a normalization of psychedelics, there's a tendency to kind of ignore or even repress the fact that modern psychedelic culture has been deeply underground in many ways and involved with criminality, but more specifically, a kind of a countercultural stream that in some ways I think gets short shrift in these discussions, as well as a kind of a need that I see for a more critical understanding of psychedelic experience and the problems that are raised and ways we think about the past, ways we think about indigenous communities today, problems raised by the popularity of ayahuasca, a lot of serious issues. And again, all these people are there, but I get a little concerned sometimes that side of the story is getting lost in the rush to raise money and attention for above board psychedelic studies. But I was enormously heartened, despite these relatively modest concerns, to receive a copy of Patrick Lundborg's magnum opus, Psychedelia, An Ancient Culture, A Modern Way of Life, which has a beautiful cover. And it's really an enormous treat and definitely one of my favorite books on psychedelia that I've come across in a number of years. There's actually been a renaissance of book publishing on psychedelic topics in America, particularly Inner Traditions has put out quite a lot of stuff. I'm not always that happy with it. There are some real gems in there. In fact, we'll be talking to one of their authors in a few weeks. Robert Tyndall wrote a really interesting book about the shamanism in ancient Greek mythology on its relationship to contemporary healing cultures. But Lundberg's book really takes the cake. And what I love about it, there's a number of things I love about it. One is that it's full of data, intensely researched book. His earlier book is Acid Archives, which is a collector geek psychedelic treasure trove of data and information on psychedelic music. So it's like for the hardcore. It's not a casual, you know, a purchase or a mellow ride. It's a data dense collector's dream. And Patrick brings some of that energy to this book, but at the same time, it takes off in all sorts of other directions. And though he's read, you know, tons of scholarship and really engages with some of the most important thinkers in psychedelic studies in terms of contemporary understandings, in terms of understanding the past, questions of potential psychedelic influence on the, you know, Greek mystery traditions, et cetera, et cetera. He doesn't really write exactly as a scholar. There's a playfulness. There's a kind of essayistic quality to the book, which makes it a bit enormous because it's big and full of ideas and kind of rages all over the place, but makes it very inviting and quite playful. Like one example, one of my favorite chapters that I've read, I haven't read the whole thing, he starts off talking about Apocalypse Now, and he recognizes rightly that it's really a movie that's as much about psychedelics as anything else, and you know, certainly California consciousness lays as heavily on that as the actual Vietnam War. And then he starts taking that idea and tracing it through Eliot's The Wasteland and ideas about mystery traditions and you know, Weston's book on the Grail mysteries, and then looping it around into Yeats and Peyote. It's really marvelous kind of movements through all of these different domains, which is, of course, what makes psychedelic thinking so and writing so interesting. But with that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Do you ever have, like really powerful shamanic dreams, like where you're kind of, I mean, I know you, I'm sure you have, but like you become identified with an animal, or you're in the forest, or you sort of become another being.
Yeah, man. I had one of my gnarliest ones was I was on the beach, and a great white shark swam up to the beach, and I was like, oh, I'm cool, it can't get me. And then he crawled up on the beach and ate me, and then swam out to sea, and I was in the belly of the shark, and then the shark gave birth to me, and I came out a shark, and then I was swimming up to a beach, and I saw myself on the beach as the shark that I came out of.
I just had this intuition that was the right question to ask.
Yeah, so yeah. I have a lot of those.
that's perfect. Well, that'll be our sort of inaugural vision for the conversation. So, Patrick, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric.
It's great to have you. You're calling from Stockholm, right?
That's right.
Good. Well, it sounds like our connection isn't too crazy. Yeah, there's so many places to start, but I guess I am kind of interested a little bit in your story and the process of leading to this book, because I was familiar with Acid Archives, which is a great, you know, success, a very popular book. People love it. But I wouldn't necessarily have expected that your next, you know, major book would have ranged so far and so wide through anthropology and philosophy and cognitive science and history and religious studies and all this kind of material. So maybe I'm just kind of curious a little bit more about you and how your fascination and obsession even with modern psychedelic culture and music sort of, you know, opened up into this much, much larger project.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not the only one to be kind of surprised by this step that I took with the new book, because most people know me as a music writer and a reviewer of records and so forth. But the whole thing goes back to 20 years when we formed a kind of an artist collective here in Stockholm called the Lumber Island Acid Crew, which is kind of a jokey name that I came up with. And we patterned ourselves on, you know, the Merry Pranksters and Tim Leary's Millbrook Group, and created kind of a psychedelic culture for ourselves and club, if you want. And out of that came all kinds of creative activities. But I couldn't quite find, most of those involved were there were other musicians or artists. And my thing that I wanted to do was to write. That was my specialty. So I started writing in Swedish, and I tried writing novels, and I wrote some poems. And I got some poems published in Sweden's biggest literary magazine, but it never felt quite right, so I kind of gave up on that. And then about 10 years ago, I started writing in English instead of Swedish. And it was weird because it flowed much easier for me, the language, when I wrote in English than my Swedish, my natural language, but it flowed better in English. And so I started writing about music because that was my specialty that people knew of. And that from that came the Acid Archives that you know. But all the time since the late 1980s, I've always had a greater interest in psychedelic culture and bought all the books and magazine clippings I've found and things like that. So for me, it was a natural step to expand the whole trip to psychedelic culture in general. But those who know me, they know me as a music writer. So there has been some surprise, yeah.
Yeah, I want to say this again, is that there's a lot of, you know, as you know, partly because psychedelic culture has been so underground in the 20th century, that a lot of the important books, you know, come out of, they're either, you know, they're independently published, or they're published on small presses, or a lot of the theories, and there's, you know, some very significant exceptions as well, but a lot of the deeper thinking about psychedelics has been done by people who are outside of academia, even if they're wrestling with intellectual problems, and they're reading anthropology, they're trying to understand the big issues in these fields. And that means that you kind of part of the territory is this mixture of, you know, maybe more conventional ways of understanding, interpreting the world, like scientific ways of understanding, you know, neurology and cognitive factors. And then there's often mixtures with, like, crazy ideas and, like, you know, marvelous cosmic maps and, models of how quantum physics relates to, you know, DMT, et cetera, et cetera. And those things, you know, they can be very inspiring and interesting in some ways. I tend to read them kind of like science fiction or a sort of visionary poem that just takes the form of an argument about how the world works. But your book gets to a really beautiful place in between, where you're engaged with some of those more cosmic questions, some of the trickier concepts, but you also stay in a framework where you're really wrestling with some of the intellectual problems that have to do with how we think about these things and how we deal with other people's experiences. And so it's a really nice blend, and good to see that you had the oomph to get it out there on your own. And your English is really good. It's very sprightly and fun. And fun to read. And I guess, you know, there's so many things that you cover, so many things we could talk about. I mean, maybe a good place to start is to talk a little bit about music, because that's sort of where you've come from as a writer, and also there's a lot of that material in there. What's kind of special or particular about music as a gateway into this larger psychedelic culture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I actually thought about that the other day. Why music? Why not movies, say, or you know, the plastic arts? And the psychedelic experience is primarily visual, I think most people would agree. But when in that state, music seems to be the most effective stimuli or input that you can have. And I'm not sure why. It's maybe it demands just about enough of your sensory input for you to continue expanding in the psychedelic state and stimulating your mind, but not overtaking it, something like that. In any event, it's like what people say about the 60s nowadays, you know, younger people, they say, well, what was good about the 60s was the drugs and the music. That's what, you know, everyone has been going back to. The other stuff, you know, like the politics and so forth, that's just fallen behind. It's the drugs and the music. So there's a connection there that's very, very interesting. And of course, psychedelic music, the match between rock music and psychedelic drugs that occurred in 1965 and 66, that was, you know, perfect marriage, like a match made in heaven, really.
Yeah, and how do you see that as a kind of historian? One of the questions that that people raise now is that, you know, the movement of psychedelics outside of kind of an elite world of psychotherapists and doctors and people working inside institutions who are trying to explore these things and study them and do proper scientific studies. And then, you know, over the course of the early 60s, there's this transition until there's an explosion and a release of these materials into the popular culture, which helps fuel the counterculture and then create, you know, everything that's come since. And it's sort of an interesting moment because, you know, some people kind of see that as a bit of a fall because in a way it took us away from the sort of scientific legitimation and sort of healing capacities because we're, you know, it becomes part of criminality and da-da-da. And then, of course, on the other hand, there's this enormous explosion of cultural creativity and all these, you know, massively influential things, and, you know, spirituality and all these things that could not be imagined without that kind of explosion. I'm curious how you see that. Why did that happen? What's important or interesting about that shift from the smaller, more elite world to the popular culture?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic because if you look back and you read the literature from the early 60s, like, you know, the Psychedelic Review magazine that Leary and Alpert and Metzner put out, if you read things published then from the, you know, the pre-Beatle era, there is nothing about music in there, not even classical music or jazz. They have no interest in music whatsoever. And then there is a shift in 64, 65, when rock bands primarily get into psychedelic interest, and then the whole thing explodes in 66 and 67. And what is usually said is that people like Allen Ginsberg and Alan Watts, who were interested in spreading the psychedelic message, kind of tied these worlds together. You know, Ginsberg, he knew Leary and he knew Huxley, but he also knew the Beatles and he knew the Byrds and people in San Francisco and so on. And I think it was a few guys who helped that transition. And then the other thing, of course, is that psychedelic drugs became available as a street drug from 65 and onwards. And so we didn't have to have the access to Sandoz chemicals or Leary's stash in Millbrook or whatever. The people in rock music that picked up the psychedelic message the earliest were the folk musicians, which is pretty interesting. This is rarely understood. But it was the folk guys who began in 64, 65 to take an interest in psychedelic drugs. And they had already tried peyote and mushrooms and were no strangers to the experience. And that's what you get when you look at a band like the Byrds in Los Angeles. Those guys had dropped acid as early as 63 or 64, before the Beatles and anyone else. And in San Francisco, of course, all the early bands like Jefferson Airplane and so on, they were ex-folkies too. And there was also a connection between New York and the early folk boom scene and then Los Angeles and San Francisco, which is where the folkies moved out in the mid-60s.
So yeah, I believe that... Go ahead.
Yeah, and I believe that that's sort of the main channel was... Leary and his friends really had nothing to do with this transition, although they influenced a lot of other things. It was in 65, I think, was the crucial year for this.
One of the other things that happens right around there, and I was particularly interested in some of your thoughts on this in the book, your reflections on it, is that as people started to go deeper into psychedelic experience, partly because they were reading about it, like Leary and Alpert put out this, you know, crazy book, The Psychedelic Experience, that's this trip guide, very loosely based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But it was very popular, and right at that moment, 64, 65, people were really using it. Like, it really was a trip guide. And partly through that, and partly through the just remarkable phenomenology of psychedelic experience, people started to interpret the visions they saw, or even experienced visions, in a kind of religious way. Whether we mean religion in terms of, you know, Western religion, or in terms of bodhisattvas and, you know, shamanic, you know, that there was this idea that there's something religious about psychedelic experience, and that really is a very important discourse for certainly the 60s and 70s, really a lot of people, etc. And you have some interesting comments on that, on both the way in which that makes sense, but also the way that it obscures some of what you consider to be like a more authentic and genuine message about, you know, what the psychedelics ultimately teach us about the world, about the self, about spirituality. I mean, I know it's a big question, but I was really interested in those thoughts, so I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit about wrestling with the topic of religion in psychedelics.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a big, complex question, and that is like 20, 25 pages, I think, in the book. But first of all, this is one area where Leary and his friends definitely had an influence. That book, which is almost unreadable today in the psychedelic experience, really influenced a lot of people, I believe, at that time. Later on, people began ridiculing it. Even Leary himself and the other guys kind of distanced themselves from it. But it was an early influence in steering people towards a kind of a Buddhist interpretation of the psychedelic experience, for good and for bad. What I say in the book is that during the 70s, I think in particular, there was this idea that you don't have to do psychedelic drugs because they're just an inferior or paler version of the true path, which is like Buddhist meditation or Hindu meditation. And so a lot of people moved out of their psychedelic habits into these, where they signed up with ashrams or started doing transcendental meditation with a Maharishi or things like that. And this idea lingered for many years. When I got into this in the early to mid-80s, this idea still lingered that, you know, psychedelic drugs, they're okay, but if you really want to do something that takes you somewhere, you have to do the real path, which is the old religious spiritual training path. And what I say in the book is that this is not really true at all. It's more like a confused and maybe for political reasons, idea that has surfaced during the 70s. Terence McKenna once said that all that stuff that he calls New Age and New Spiritualism and so on was people escaping from the difficulties of the psychedelic experience. They couldn't handle the trip, simply put. And so they found a way out of it by going into the Buddhist meditation and so on. I think he has a point. It's a little harsh, but I think he has a point in that people were burned out and they felt that they could have the same thing without the risks and dangers of the psychedelic trip. But my belief is that these different paths are very valid, all of them, but they take you to different places. The psychedelic path is its own path, and I think that the shamanic paradigm that we've seen now since, I don't know, about last 20 years, is the proper one. It's certainly better than the Buddhist view of it. And so if you approach the psychedelics and the related experience through a shamanic perspective, then it makes sense. You understand what you can do. You can do healing, and you have a complete spiritual world within reach, which has these, whatever people call them, entities or strong forces and energies and so on. And there's a good match between that shamanic world and what you actually experience in a higher psychedelic state.
Well, here's the question. Go ahead.
Whereas with when you start mapping it against, say, the Buddhist, the full Buddhist path towards a Bodhisattva state, pretty soon you see the divergences. They don't match up at all. The Buddhist works towards non-dualism. It works towards the void. It works towards emptiness, whereas the psychedelic space is anything but empty. It's crowded with, you know, crazy colors and beings and visions. And so the idea that, you know, the one replaces the other is, to me, is baroque. I don't know that
and
people bought
it. It is partly political because, you know, I've contributed to a book you're probably familiar with called Zigzag Zen, which really looks at the connections between psychedelics and American Buddhism. And the thing is, if you actually hang around the scenes and talk to people and even talk to old hands and even some teachers, they'll admit that they recognize this and that the two are complementary more than one replacing the other. But for various reasons, including political ones, the visible story, you know, the surface story is that, well, we did drugs, and then we discovered meditation, and that was the real deal, and so we were done. It's actually much more complicated than that on the ground. But I had a different question for you. I mean, I want to talk about shamanism and ayahuasca in a little bit, but before we get there, it's that when you talk about the psychedelic path as being its own path, especially within the modern cultural world that you spend a lot of time, you know, really the heart of your book is in the modern experience and the Western experience, though it's, of course, relating to these other streams of anthropology and ancient history, that within that modern context, does the psychedelic path just sort of bring you to the shamanic worldview, or is in some ways, is there a psychedelic path that's specific to itself or specific to our modern way of life? And it seems like you point that way sometimes, and you talk about some of the kind of core message of that path. It's that you can relate to shamanism, but I'm kind of almost curious, like, what is it in the West? Like, what is it within Western psychedelic culture? What is the essence of the path?
Yeah. If you look at the psychedelic experience, you go through different levels. And the first level, or the second level, like the first important level is the one which is a therapeutic cleansing, and that is basically, you know, when you open up the doors towards, you know, the old skeletons that you haven't dealt with and that you now have to deal with, and that I think is the first step on the path, which psychedelics help facilitate very quickly, and if you prepare yourself diligently, then it won't be particularly unpleasant. A little challenging, but it's a very important step forward. Then once you've done that, and you may need a few experiences to work out all the hang-ups and defenses and things like that, then you start moving into an impersonal realm, and this is what the shamans do with their training. You get into a space that is not about you, but it's about the world and about the people around you and about energy and about healing. And the shamans and the shamanistic model is a specific interpretation of the ayahuasca using tribes develop from their experiences a whole system of both world, you know, upper world, middle world, and underworld, and also the entities that they have to deal with and the type of healing that they have to do. And what I said earlier, that the shamanistic model is better fit for the psychedelic experience than the Buddhist model, I believe that it is. I think it's a more fruitful paradigm or metaphor for the psychedelic experience. But just like your question implies here, I do not think that the shamanistic model is identical to the essence of the psychedelic path. It's more like a better understanding of it. It's a step forward. And that is where I think Terence McKenna and also guys like Michael Harner have done a lot of very important work in bringing us out of the old 60s perspective.
Well, and that's
into
the thing. There's a huge difference between the shamanistic psychedelic experience and then like the recreational psychedelic experience, mm-hmm. right? With the shamans, they're actually using the meditations and techniques as a navigation system for while you're in the state, whereas like I feel like a lot of what happened in the 60s was just kind of got everybody in the state, and then there was like no direction, no purpose, no like kind of what do I do now? So it was like you were kind of in the same boat where that they were before they were experienced. Okay, now I'm just like this over here, but what does that mean? Whereas the shamans are actually like, okay, like here's this thing. What are we going to do there, right? Or what are we going to be, or how do we deal with this kind of thing is sort of how I look at it.
And so to pick up with what happens once the psychedelic culture or psychedelic philosophy moves away from the shamanic viewpoint, which is useful but a step on the path, is what I describe in the book is this heritage that we have from all the way back to Eleusis in Greece and the ancient celebrations there. And I see it as resting on two important pillars. One is the everyday life, our mundane life, which I describe as with a number of psychedelic experience behind you, you develop a kind of attitude which is what Alan Watts called a purposeless play. Alan Watts describes in The Joyous Cosmology, his book, what he means by this purposeless play. And it's an attitude towards life which is kind of Taoist and very easy to understand for a psychedelic person. And that is how you sort of live your everyday life. You could say that the Merry Pranksters were pretty close to that attitude also. So that is the mundane life. And then you have the celestial life for the psychedelic person, which is I see as a kind of platonic thing, where you have the notion and also, in fact, the experience of a higher world existing. And this higher world throws its light back on the mundane life and gives you a kind of confirmation and hope for a higher existence. And if you've been through some really profound psychedelic experience, you know that this exists. You know it without a shiver of a doubt that there is something else there. And so you have the purposeless play, which is your everyday life, and then you have something else that is above you, and you know it, and you keep in contact with it. And that's what the celebrations at Eleusis were about. And to some extent, that's what the rave parties are about, and the human being that they had in San Francisco and so on, maintaining a contact with a higher spiritual world, which is a psychedelic oriented.
Well, how do you feel about people get just by doing the psychedelics with no guidance, they have the realization that there's that higher place. But then the flip side of getting the hope and kind of reassurance of the spiritual world is the fear and paranoia. Like, why do psychedelics, when some people will experience that higher realm, they become, like, you know, kind of paranoid or almost schizophrenic as a result of it, instead of kind of coming into communication with their higher self, they can kind of go the other direction too. I mean, what do you think that is?
Absolutely. There are definite risks here, and I always emphasize that. And my idea is what I talked about earlier. You have to, first of all, you have to do the inner cleansing. You have to know yourself. And there's basically no difference between doing this through a couple of fairly low dose psychedelic drugs or going into therapy like people do and mm-hmm. work out your problems. But that takes like a year. And you can do it in a month or two with the psychedelic drugs if you prepare yourself carefully, have someone there with you. And then you work out these things that you can leave behind the classic psychodynamic baggage simply. And once you've done away with that, the risk for negative experiences diminishes radically, because the stuff that comes in and haunts you and frightens you is almost always things that are connected to you as a person. And in the higher psychedelic realms, things become very impersonal. And then, this is also true for the shamanic realms. And it's more like receiving messages, and it's more like you becoming someone, not necessarily a shaman, but becoming a person who receives instruction and views of a higher place that you can then share with others. So I believe most of the negative experiences come from people who basically walk in from the street, take a much too high dose of psychedelics, and then are confronted with the demons that they didn't even know they had inside them. And then things can go really bad.
That's a wonderful answer. I think the one other thing I'd like to say that I don't think is given enough language in the scene is that there's another risk that happens for people, especially once they've gone through a lot of their psychodynamic stuff. I don't think it ever really disappears entirely, but who have spent time in that impersonal realm, is that then there's a problem of what psychologists call inflation, that you have, you think you know, you've seen, you've experienced, you've had the gnosis, you have the charisma. And I've seen a lot of people kind of, you know, hurt themselves and sort of become jerks by not sort of also recognizing or getting the message about humility, which I think is also has to do with that ordinary, purposeless play that you talked about. We got to take a break right here. We'll be right back on Expanding Minds, talking to Patrick Lundberg about psychedelia.
On the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we're plunging into the exploration of the consciousness. Today with Patrick Lundberg and talking about psychedelia. And before the break, Patrick, we were talking a little bit about kind of navigating some of those fear places, and you had mentioned about the kind of backlash from the new age movement trying to go just into meditation and avoiding it. But now there's been a lot of resurgences with the acceptability of all these things, with all the ayahuasca things and things like that. And I was curious if in your research and watching like kind of some of the anthropological trends, if you kind of mapped or saw any effect on society as a whole as a result of, you know, wider usage of psychedelics.
Anthropology as a field became very important for me when I wrote the book. I ended up reading dozens of books on anthropology, which was very interesting and which I wasn't really familiar with earlier. So I think anthropology has replaced psychology as the, I believe, most fruitful field for understanding the psychedelic experience from one of the established fields of science. And one thing that I pointed out in the book when we talk about ayahuasca and the wider use of ayahuasca is that some of the tribes in Amazonia who are completely immersed in ayahuasca use, they do not necessarily display any kind of peaceful Shangri-La type society norms or behavior or codes. Rather, they are as they may be as fierce and as hostile towards strangers and as uncompromising in their internal affairs as any other tribe in Amazonia. And so I found it very interesting to learn that the Shuar tribe, the Xibaro, as they were known earlier, who are known for headhunting and things like that in the past, they have always been known as one of the most dangerous tribes in South America. Maybe very exaggerated, but they are very heavy ayahuasca users. So you try to put those two together, and you see that there isn't necessarily any effect on society or the tribe just because they do a lot of psychedelic drugs or have, in fact, integrated psychedelic drugs into their entire cosmology and healing and so on. And that was one thing that surprised me quite a bit when I read about this. This is still in the context of the Aboriginal tribes. But I think it was a kind of a lesson learned there that the step towards creating a society that is somehow shaped by psychedelic experiences is not a very easy one. There may not be a connection at all, in fact.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's some really, really good medicine you're just providing there that I wish more people would take, and particularly about anthropology. It's kind of confused me that there's so many really good, I mean, they have their problems, but there's so many really good anthropological accounts just of, you know, Amazonian shamanism, and you learn so much, and you are forced to deal with these kinds of questions, with the dark side of it, with brujos, with the fierceness in the society. And then the other thing you encounter, which is also sort of forgotten in the current kind of ayahuasca fantasy I think I've talked about on the show before, is the incredible difference between, you know, indigenous, relatively traditional or strongly traditional use of ayahuasca and the mestizo experience, where you have people who are moving into the area and they're like, they're mutts and they come from somewhere else and they're half African American and they're whatever, and they start using this stuff. They come in, you know, initially with waves of the rubber trappers, and the very 20th century phenomenon. And it's of course those guys that give us the first ayahuasca religions that really have an impact on northern Europeans, you know, people, right, in Northern Americans and Europeans, people started to go down and go to Santo Daime and et cetera. And there's a real confusion about how different mestizo experience is from traditional shamanism and all the fantasies about living in balance with nature and all this kind of stuff, which is beautiful, and there's some very important ideas there, but in a lot of ways, ayahuasca is more of a mestizo experience, and in some sense, we're, you know, the Western, you know, ayahuasca shamans coming down to drink, often with mestizo shamans, in a way, they're participating already in this sort of modern mixture where there's a lot of different things that are going on, which I think is actually kind of a positive thing, you know, that it's not just about trying to emulate these rare tribes that are amazingly holding on to some kind of coherent traditional life in the jungle, which does happen and is extraordinary. But rather than fantasizing about getting to that, leave those guys alone. Let them do what they're doing. Hang out with the mestizos. These guys are like you. They're just different, and they've had much more experience, and some of them are powerful healers. But give up the fantasy to me gets in the way, and you did some good stuff in the book as well. You talk about Taussig's book, Colonialism, Shamanism, and the Wild Man, which is a tough book, but it's really, really valuable. I wish more people would read and talk about that one as well, because that's so much about the mestizo experience and politics and the modern world and the way those things are not separate from ayahuasca use in the jungle. But where do you see this stuff going? Where do you see ayahuasca religion in the West, or the development of psychedelic science? Do you think, are we going into like a science phase now? Are the esoteric kind of Platonic elements going to be sort of hidden, or are we just on the verge of some, you know, revolutionary models of mind that help us understand what's going on in deep space psychedelia? Where do you see it headed?
I make the comment in the book that in Brazil, the mestizo churches like Santo Daime that you mentioned, they have managed to create precisely that which we have not been able to do in Western society, which is a new kind of a religion, basically, or religion-like experience, which is organized, which functions, and which is integrated into the society. And they have, there are at least three different, I think, in Brazil, ayahuasca churches. So that is a very impressive achievement. And we should ask ourselves why this has not happened in our countries. They're trying to export it now, or they have for 15 or 20 years, to set up ayahuasca churches in America and also here in Europe. I think they exist, but I hear no buzz about them. I never hear people talking about the local things we have here. And I don't think it's probably not the right solution for Western society either. But it's a very interesting thing. As for psychedelics in general, you mentioned earlier, which I thought was very interesting, the MAPS approach, which is very strongly geared towards mainstream medical research, and kind of making the drugs acceptable and integrated into medicine and so on. That will certainly happen, but it's nothing that really helps the psychedelic underground, which is a huge scene both in Europe and in America. And the other thing that you mentioned was the brain research and consciousness research. And that, I believe, is one path that will be rewarding in the future. And what is interesting to note is that the psychedelic drugs, with their connection to the neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, the psychedelic drugs are extremely valuable for that research. You can't go past them. And so they will continue to be used as people research the mind and how it operates, which is still today not known. No one knows for sure how the mind works and how consciousness is created. So I see an application there for psychedelic drugs, which is only at the beginning now. And this is not the same thing as the MAPS paradigm, which is
correct.
It's healing, it's therapeutical. This is a hard science research. And I think this is going to be happening during this century. And I think maybe within 100 years, there will be an understanding, not complete, but reasonable of how the mind works, how consciousness is created, and the psychedelic drugs will...
Do you have any thoughts on what the mechanism is in psychedelics that could cause people to heal? Do you feel like it's just a chemical thing? Do you think it's a consciousness related? What in your research, what do you kind of feel like the connection is between those two?
For people to become healers.
No, how does the healing how does healing happen? What is it about psychedelics that enable
I deal with that a bit in the last chapters, which are admittedly very speculative, but I'm building here on a theory from the anthropologist Michael Winkelmann, who published a very interesting book a couple of years ago, which has other psychedelic researchers have commented that he may be onto something here. And what he says is that the totality of the human, the brain apparatus, is the old theory about a triune brain, which is the reptile brain, the mammal brain, and then we have the cortex, the modern brain. And he believes that there is an, in the psychedelic state, or in maybe other agitated states as well, but in particular in the psychedelic state with the neurotransmitters running free, there is a vertical integration across the three types of brains, and in conjunction, in cooperation, the reptile brain and the mammal brain are able to identify weaknesses in your personality structure, basically, things where you are suffering, places where you're suffering, places where you are fearful, and so on. And thanks to the special consciousness state that you're in, the integrated brain is able to identify and also heal or present a solution for this problem that you have. So that's sort of the basic theory about how it works. It's very complex, and I have several pages about it in the book, but I thought it was it's the most interesting view of it that I've heard so far.
Yeah, and I think there's... Go ahead, Masha.
I was just going to say, so basically, if you just raise your consciousness level, you can figure out why you're sick, and then your body just fixes it.
Yeah, well, this is mostly about the kind of psychological hang-ups that people have.
Right.
There you can definitely... This self-healing process is very interesting, very intriguing. But what I described now is one possible theory.
Yeah, it's interesting just to see how far the more cognitive side of the discussion can take it, you know. Because if you take the phenomenology of the experience far enough, it always gets ultimately extremely weird. And some people who describe that, you talk about Benny Shannon's book a lot, and he goes through like the whole range of ayahuasca phenomenology. And while he admits that there are some anomalies, he basically wants to stay in the frame that these are experiences that are happening inside of an individual's psyche. And he does that for a variety of reasons. That's his job. So, you know, he's also has academic pressures or whatever. But it's kind of interesting to see like how far you can go with a model that's still ultimately kind of acceptable by science, but at the same time, as soon as you describe such a model, there are these very significant anomalies. And I can tell that you also have a sympathy for some of the more scientific and cognitive accounts. At the same time, you're very willing to talk about the esoteric, you know, intensities of inner space. What for you are some of the most extraordinary anomalies? Like those things about the experience that seem to suggest something profoundly different than even an expansive scientific worldview.
Yeah, I think mostly under the tryptamines, which is ayahuasca, DMT, and psilocybin, you get in the higher states the kind of healing, which is not... personal healing, but I mean personal healing. There is what Terence McKenna called the logos. I don't like that term. I call it simply the mushroom voice or the overseer, I think, in the book. And there is something in there that knows much more than you do. And it's a feeling that it's not your subconscious that knows this, but something else. It's like a supraconscious. And it knows incredibly much, not just about you, but about the world in general. And it gives you these messages, which often are very profound and intelligent. And often the problem is to remember them and take them with you back. And I've always found that this... where does this information come from? It's very hard to explain. But as Eric mentioned, my belief is that all this takes place within the mind, within the human brain. There is the other theory which says that it's some other dimension or another world that is somehow being opened up for us. And a lot of people, including psychedelic researchers, believe this. But I tend to lean towards the intrapsychic model, which is that these resources are inside your brain somehow. But I have to say with the things that you can learn and see and, you know, visions of distant cities that you've never been in, which then turn out to be correct and so on. Benny Shannon has a lot of these examples in the book you mentioned. It kind of stretches the the credibility of the intrapsychic model, because it's so bizarre. It's like, is it really possible that I can have this knowledge in my mind? And well, I tend to lean towards that, but it's hard to explain where it comes from. Is it like, is it inherited information that is stored in DNA that I'm given access to, or where does it come from? So I believe these like remote seeing and the telepathy that almost everyone does psychedelic drugs has experienced, and kind of, yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful summing up. We're going to have to end it there. We have a little bit of time left, and I just want to let you tell listeners where they can get a hold of your book and find out more about what you're doing online.
Thank you, Eric, and thanks for your kind words about my book. My book, Psychedelia, by Patrick Lundborg, is currently sold out at Amazon, but you can find it at our distributor, Forced Exposure, on their website, and also at eBay, and at a number of bookshops and record shops. So it's pretty easy to find. Just
good.
Google it, and you will find it.
Well, thanks again.
And I have a... Yeah.
So we got to wrap it up. So thanks again for being on the show. From Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open and have a wonderful bicycle day.